Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Sophie Ellis-Bextor, and welcome to Spinning Plates, the podcast where I speak to busy working women who also happen to be mothers about how they make it work. I'm a singer, and I've released 7 albums in between having my 5 sons, aged 16 months to 16 years, so I spin a few plates myself. Being a mother can be the most amazing thing, but can also be hard to find time for yourself and your own ambitions. I want to be a bit nosy and see how other people balance everything. Welcome to Spinning Plates. Hey there, darlings. How you doing? I'm sorry, I'm a little bit out of breath. I just ran into Mickey's room while he's in the hallway. I've got to go to work in a minute. It's Saturday. I am not complaining, but I am a bit tired. And sometimes when work swings around at the weekend, you do have this thing of like, oh, I just want to stay with the kids today. I just love a light, nice, lazy Saturday, enjoying this last bit of summer sunshine all together. But that's not what's happening, and that's fine. I'm going to go and sing, and I'm sure it'll be really lovely when I get there. And, oh, it's been a very strange week. I'm sure it's the same for you. Obviously, we had not wholly unexpected, but still sad news that the Queen died on Thursday. And I'm always a bit... there's always a slight out-of-body feeling for me when anything sort of massively historic happens and you're aware that it's a historic moment while you're living through it. Sort of any big news stories. I have this thing sometimes where I can picture how it's written about in the textbooks for future history students. And I sort of picture the pictures that, you know, they're going to use alongside the write-up about this period and, you know, the new king. And it's like slightly out of body. And obviously we've had lots of different emotions going on. Been quite interested in who posts what online, if I'm honest. But I think mostly people have got the tone just right. You know, she was definitely very good at being the queen. And 96 years is a very long time to be alive, let alone have such a long reign as queen. For 70 years, and I think, you know, you'd be hard pushed to find anybody that's living now that remembers life before that. So, you know, it's a significant end of an era, beginning of something new. And I had to do a gig yesterday, and I went on stage and I said to the crowd, you know, there are some times when you have a gig booked and you think it's doing a gig what everybody wants to hear, but actually, from my point of view, Music's always been a good tonic, especially if I'm feeling a bit wobbly or I'm not really sure what happens next. If there's a bit of uncertainty in the air, see reference pandemic discos. So actually doing a gig last night and being with a load of people and having our hands in the air felt really nice, actually. It's comforting, isn't it? And so to get today, I'll get a little bit more of that, I guess, when I sing later on. And this week's podcast, lovely Connie Huck. And now Connie and I, we have this really nice relationship where we always feel we're almost sort of related. We're not. It's just that we share Blue Peter. But Blue Peter is being part of our lives. Is quite a, well, I've always referred to him as Blue Peter. I always think of it as like my sibling, because I was an only child till I was 8, and my mum was presenting Blue Peter from when I was 4 to when I was 8. So for that part of my life, Blue Peter was the other person in, oh golly, very noisy motorbike. Blue Peter was like the sibling I didn't have, you know. It was like she'd be go off and do Blue Peter, and I'd watch it, and so my friends watch it, and it was this really big presence. And then obviously Connie presented Blue Peter and was in fact the longest serving presenter of Blue Peter. So, you know, we had lots to talk about with that. But also, I love seeing Connie. She always makes me laugh. We always have really good chats that go from, you know, lightweight to really putting the world to rights. And so it was a complete joy to sit down with her and just do all of that over again, but recorded. So I think you're going to enjoy this conversation, and it's going to take you on a little roller coaster, because I think Connie's very smart, and I think our brain works a million miles an hour and goes all over the shop, which I love. So we had a very bouncy, fun conversation, and hopefully lots of things that make you think. And I feel like, can you hear that little voice getting nearer? He's been up since 5:30 today. 5:30. Do you ever have that thing where you get woken up early if you have a small person in your life and they wake you up early and you just feel like that sense of no one's coming to rescue me, this is just what time my day began and now I've just got to ride it out? That's how I felt today. So after the gig last night, I didn't go to bed till about, what time was it? Must have been about 1. And then, yeah, about 5:30. Oh, and here's Richard. He's come in to check on me. I'm just doing the introduction for the podcast. Honestly, I cannot get any flipping quiet in this house. There's nowhere I can go. I feel like I have a massive magnet in my pocket and people just find me. Anyway, I'm not complaining. I'm just a tired person. And I'm very excited to have the energy of Connie's chat to lift me out of my slightly weary state. All right, let's love seeing the other side. Well, nice to see you, Connie. We've already been chatting so much already. What have we covered already?
We can't
ABBA,
stop ourselves,
technology,
can we?
modern life,
yeah.
Good, the bad, the ugly.
And everything in between, yeah. Basically, in a nutshell.
Yeah, we've also covered how you were saying you think you've sort of got the first 7 years of raising your child, like that's the bit where you're really like helping to shape the children, and then after that, it's just a matter of, you know, dealing with the fallout of all the bits you got wrong and then the therapy they'll be in from when they're 30. So, which makes me, whenever people say that thing about show me a child of 7 and I'll show you a man, I just feel like, can't I have a bit longer, please?
Yeah, it's not fair on us parents, is it? It's ridiculous that we've only got this less than a decade to shape the adults that we'll become. But I don't think we actually realise, do we, till you're maybe in your 30s, that like that weird thing you do, that mannerism, the way you're funny when it comes to such and such situation, all of it comes from your upbringing.
So much so. And I think in families, there's certain things that are celebrated and certain things that aren't, that go a bit more under the radar. And those things, those characteristics, what's brought out of people. Like, for example, in my house, I realised this big time in lockdown, because it was very annoying, that I'd always praised a little bit of anarchy and being a little bit silly as well. So when it came to trying to do homeschooling, those things came back to bite me quite considerably.
Yes. I can so relate to it. I think that was the worst part of lockdown for me, homeschooling.
Mm.
And you think, oh, you know, I was like, oh, I've been a Blue Peter presenter for all those years, I'll be fine. But It was just a nightmare. It was horrible. I hated it. And for you, I can only imagine with five, yeah, and they're all doing different stuff. And
yeah, I felt like I'd just bitten off more than I could chew. Where basically, I was like, what was I thinking, having so many children? I thought I'd been so, you know, clever and yes, great and gung-ho. And yeah, I was like, whoa, I don't know if I could actually deal with the spectrum. Anymore. Yeah. But, well, yeah, we obviously have our... We're sort of related by Blue Peter.
I know, I do feel like it's like a sort of weird...
Cousins or something.
It is like that, isn't it? It's yeah, like we're family. And even, you know, when your mum just rang you early, it's like, oh, I just saw her the other day. And but yeah, it is like that. I do think in a weird way, sort of the world of media and show business is like this extended weird... Not quite family. I'd say Blue Peter is family. I'd say we're family, we're cousins.
Yeah.
But it's this weird sort of thing, isn't it? Where you're all sort of enforced upon each other now and then. And lots of people you like, some people you might not quite click with as much, but your paths will cross and everyone else's paths will cross. So it's kind of like 6 degrees of separation, but only it's sort of 3 degrees or two sometimes. It's a bit weird, isn't it?
What are your memories now looking back of your sort of Blue Peter years? Do you think about it much at all? Does it cross your mind?
You know what? So I don't know whether you feel this, but now, so I'm in my mid to late 40s now, and actually, sometimes I look back at things and I almost think like it's almost like that was another person. It's so long ago, and there's so much crammed in our brains now. I remember when I got to what I sort of think of as the tipping point, where I would say that I used to just remember everything. I didn't even need to write things down. I've never been a big sort of diary person for appointments and things like that. I used to keep everything in my head. And there came that sort of time where I realised that actually it's got to the point where there's so much stuff in my head. I am forgetting that face or that I've done this thing. And if you think about the fact that on Blue Peter, we were filming 5 shows a week at certain point when the CBBC channel came in, we were doing 2 shows on digital on the Tuesday and the Thursday, and then Monday, Wednesday and Friday we were on terrestrial.
Wow.
And so the amount that we were doing, it got to the point where I remember I went to Woburn Abbey with the kids, and then somebody at Woburn Abbey was saying, oh, do you remember when you came and you filmed? And actually, we had only filmed links, so we'd filmed some links, me and one of the other presenters, to link another sort of show together. And I literally had no recollection of it. And they really had to jog my memory. And then I did sort of, I vaguely remember that. And I thought, when is the time? You know, there's all these things that are just continually dropping out of our brains.
Yeah.
And actually, you almost need your memory jogged on stuff to keep renewing, you know, keep that sort of channel alive in your brain, that pathway. And now, I guess it's only, you know, I did over 10 years on that program, and there's loads of standout times and loads of memories.
But yeah, you can't. Like, honey, like,
you absolutely can't. That's exactly it. And also, so there's so many, you do so many brilliant things, but it's almost like, you know, you're spoiled. And, you know, that's probably why I never wanted to leave, because every day was just so fun. It was just mad.
Oh, that's really lovely, though, that you remember it as being really fun. But going up to 5 shows a week is a lot.
I know.
So I think my mum did 2. It was 2 shows a week.
Yeah,
back
so
in her
I
day.
Always call it Blue Peter years. So I always say, like, dog years. Blue Peter years aren't normal. So I don't know if you, I don't know, have a relationship, or if you, I don't know, you take up doing that hobby for 3 years or something, it's Blue Peter years. So it's different because the time just flies by.
Yeah.
And you're doing so much other stuff in that time. It's not like you can put yourself into anything else 100% really.
As the daughter of someone that was doing Blue Peter when I was little, people were constantly making links between what my mum was doing on Blue Peter and the sort of child that they thought I was having. So there's been lots of times when people say, oh, does your mum come and do makes with you or something? Because I suppose the whole relationship that people form with the presenters when they're growing up, they have that sort of... I always felt like Blue Peter presenters were sort of like the, you know, like young parent type role.
Yeah.
Not quite older sibling, actually. It was like a young parent that kind of was guiding you.
Over the years, it's changed.
Yeah,
I
agree with that
too. So, you know, I used to watch people like Tony Hart or Valerie...
Yes.
Well, I didn't quite watch Valerie Singleton, but back in the day, people would watch Valerie Singleton, and they they felt much more mature, didn't
yes.
they?
Yes, and then it got, I agree with you that Blue Peter, it changed to yeah. being that more older sibling.
Then it's like fun aunt, and then it's yeah, like fun, yeah, yeah. young parent, then it's like older sibling. You're absolutely right.
But do you think there are any connections between the skill set you got from the show and parenting?
Yeah, you know what? I genuinely love sort of crafting, upcycling, making stuff, like all of that. And my younger son loves, like, he'll literally engineer stuff out of cardboard boxes with hinges and sort of like make, you know, on World Book Day, I'll just be like, oh, just, you know, just dress up in green or something and be Robin Hood, or, you know, something really basic. And he will actually put a costume together and make it of his own volition, and it will sort of be 3D and really good and actually quite impressive, not like it's just sort of made by an 8-year-old, which he is essentially. So he's really got that knack, and I quite enjoy doing stuff like that.
I love that too, actually. I love crafty things.
Yeah, I like all of it. Like, we'll sew stuff, or we'll, you know, all of that creating stuff. Whereas my older son, I think he takes after dad more, and he's much more into sort of coding and computers and stuff like that. And I'm always saying, actually, that, you know, Charlie's digital and I'm very analog, you know. So if something was made out of clockwork, that would be fine for me. You know, when my phone has like a, you know, an iOS update, I'm always like, oh no, I don't know how to use it anymore.
Oh yeah, that feeling. You're like, oh no, they've moved everything around.
Yeah, why did they do that? I'm very much, if it ain't broke, why fix it?
I like
it?
The old one.
Yeah, exactly that.
Well, I know that for my mum, she actually trained as an actress and then ended up presenting, sort of slightly fell into it. What was your... What was your path to it?
So basically, so I've always, like, growing up, I was always really torn between sort of the arts and the sciences, you could say. So basically,
is that the case in your family as well? Because you're youngest of three, is that right?
I'm the youngest of three, and my parents came over in the 60s, and as with a lot of parents that come over from sort of countries like Bangladesh, they want to give you a good education. And, you know, so they wanted, and actually, you know, from their background, the revered professions essentially were like sort of doctor, accountant, engineer, you know, these sort of sciencey STEM things. It seems very glamorous, and you've made it if you're any of those things. And then, you know, we came over here, and there, you know, here it's glamorous to be, you know, fashion model or singer or on telly or actress or whatever. And I always liked sort of performing. So I was in my local theatre group, like Questa's Theatre in Ealing, growing up. I used to like doing acting lessons there. And at school as well, I did my Drama Guild Hall grades. But it was always very much a sort of hobby. And so I was doing like all science, the A-levels, maths, physics, chemistry, further maths as well. But I was in the National Youth Music Theatre, and I still loved enjoying all that stuff. And auditions were advertised in Time Out for TV presenters. So me and my sisters all went along. But I was doing A-levels at that point. But I'd already done my maths A-level just finished the first year of sixth form. And basically, I wasn't expecting to get this job. It was just sort of for a fun day.
When you say
your
sister, did they all audition as well?
Yeah, all
three of us.
Well, it was open auditions. This is like, so this is how old we are. This is going back to what, the early 90s. And these open auditions advertised in Time Out were for a cable and satellite pop music programme. But this is before, you know, we had many digital channels. This was in the days of like B Sky B, if you remember. So
yeah, yeah.
Going way back. So I was just going for fun, which is probably why I ended up getting this job, because I wasn't really trying
too much
so
invested
hard.
In it.
Yeah, exactly. And so I had told them when I filled out the forms that I was unemployed and that I'd left school, which, considering I looked about 3 years old back then, is amazing that they actually believed that. But anyway. So basically, I really wanted to do this job, but then I was still at school and I had quite a cool head of sixth form, who's incidentally John Sargent's wife, which is just a coincidence. But anyway, so Mrs. Sargent, she was like, well, this would look really good on your UCCA form. She managed to wangle it. So I dropped further maths, and I'd already done maths A-level. So I just had to do physics and chemistry in my second year of A-level. So I had all these free periods and they got me a pager because this is sort of pre even mobile phones, or mobile phones were like a brick.
Oh, definitely.
A huge brick that was in a leather briefcase.
That was a bit of a novelty if you knew someone with a mobile.
Yeah.
I remember those days, Connie.
Exactly. This is, oh my gosh, we're showing our age here. So they got me a bleeper, not even a pager. And I would be bleeped and then they would tell me, and I was like the roving reporter. So they gave me a job on it where I didn't have to present full time, but I was like a roving reporter, but I was also a presenter in the studio, but I only had to record my links every Thursday evening after school, and then I could do the reporting sort of in my free periods because I was only doing two subjects by then. So it's great. I interviewed like Take That and E17 and The Farm, and it was, you know, it was really fun, and, you know, it helped my kudos as well at school. You know, it was really surreal, actually. But, you know, by then, obviously, I'd got the telly bug because it was like, this is be good to do for a living. And so I did go to uni, but I didn't do sciences. I did economics to have a sort of degree to fall back on. And then after uni, then I got the Blue Peter job. So, yeah, so I sort of... Yeah.
Do you think it helped that you were the youngest of the three that did the thing that was, I mean, as you say, like the prized careers were sort of in...
Yes. So in the sciences. No, you're absolutely right. And I think it helped that I went and did the degree in economics.
You had that to fall back on.
Yeah, exactly.
You had an employable skill.
And it also helped that, the remuneration that I was getting at quite a young age was kind of quite good for, someone that's only 16 years old or whatever. So... and also Blue Peter is a really sort of respectable job. It's something your parents can be proud of.
Yeah, it's got a heritage show, isn't it?
It wasn't like I was, I don't know, doing QVC or something. I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that QVC is bad in any way, but my parents were sort of like, really up for it, essentially. So,
it's a recognised solid brand
for
of TV.
The BBC.
And the BBC,
exactly,
yes.
Exactly, all of that stuff. So, yeah, that is how I got the gig, I guess. And then, that gig lasted for ages because, like I say, I'm quite happy with stability. I'm one of these... Or if I'm, I like to... I was so happy on that show. Why mess that up, I guess?
Yeah. No. And if you said before, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And if it's something's working for you and you're having a lovely time and engaged, there's no point to... move on. And
you know what?
Stuff
I always
happening.
Think as well, it's really suited to me because I love lots of different things.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in lots of different things, but I'm also quite flighty. I want to do a bit of everything, but not necessarily anything in major depth, if that makes sense, which is the perfect job for a Blue Peter presenter because you're doing all these different things, but you're sort of having a go at them.
You
don't have to be amazing at them. And people often think you're really sporty if you're a Blue Peter presenter, and I'm not. And what's good is that I'm quite good at sport until stamina is necessary. Like a tennis, if I'm playing tennis, I'm quite good for maybe one game, but then I can't run for the ball anymore quite quickly, So actually it's quite good for filming where you have to just sort of get a certain amount in a certain amount
of time.
Sounds
perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect for you. Also, I think what you're talking about there is being curious about lots of things and having that thirst for knowledge and information. And shows like Blue Peter are perfect for that because they'll be like, are you interested in this? And you go, well, yes, I am actually.
Yeah.
Up to a point. Yeah. Show me what you know and I'll see how much further
exactly.
I want to take it.
I'm sort of interested in everything up to a point.
But if I could fast forward a little, I wondered if you always wanted to have children. Was that something you always saw?
I did. I always wanted to have kids. Actually, I always thought I'd have three kids. And then I had two and I was like, I'm done now. Or I either thought that or I'll now get another boy. But actually, I'm really glad that I have two boys now. Because, I mean, obviously all parents are glad with what they have. I couldn't imagine it any other way. But weirdly, Charlie didn't think he'd ever want kids. He didn't think he was a having kid kind of person. So when we got together, I was like, well, if you're not having kid kind of person, then we're not compatible. But actually, it turns out he was a having kid kind of person. And he's really good with kids, actually, which you might not think if you just have seen him on the telly and you've seen his sort of miserable alter ego. But he's a lamb in wolf's clothing, I think.
So but didn't you get together and get married very swiftly?
Yes.
So did those conversations about starting a family happen within that swiftly?
Yeah, because, right, so I was mid-30s. And it's that, when you're in your mid-30s with the body clock ticking, obviously you're sort of thinking, I don't want to just be in another relationship that doesn't go anywhere. Now I'm ready for the real deal or whatever. Quite quickly, it was like, yeah, my way or the highway. So, which is good because then you know if someone's really committed, maybe. I don't know. Either that was all or within... I forced him into it and he's living a lie. I don't know. But he's doing well with living the lie. He's convinced me that he's enjoying the ride. I think really he sort of... I don't know, I think maybe it was just an overhang from sort of being young and in London. He grew up in Oxfordshire in a village and he sort of moved to London and was sort of doing his thing. And actually, yeah, he hadn't sort of thought about maybe the longer term and kids, maybe.
But I'm still quite impressed because I think, is it right that you got together and then got married within 9 months?
Yeah.
So it's quite a lot of really big conversation. Quick. That is quick.
Yes, no, but literally, because I think I just knew, I was literally like, okay... there's no point in us being together unless you're sure you definitely want to have kids and quite quickly as well. he was up for all that because, you know, sometimes you have to, and actually if that had scared him off, then he wasn't the right person. You know, I do think there's this thing where, you know, people, if a relationship breaks up or whatever, and then people are often like, oh no, but, you know, that would have been so good. They're not the same person that you got together with. Because this person doesn't want to be with you if they've gone, you know, and then they don't have good taste, essentially. Because the person you got together with wants to be with you. And whether they've changed or whatever's happened, something's changed in them, or whether you've changed, it doesn't matter. Because the person you want to be with is not them, something's gone wrong. And
that's the sort of thing that your friend can see from the outside looking in, but when you're in it, you can't see it.
No, that's the thing.
That's a sort of bit of the delusional
side.
I can
change.
Exactly, exactly. But that whole thing of like, no, there's a gap there and you're filling the gap with what you want rather than the reality of what's there.
Yeah, and lots of, I think women in particular, you can often mould or you often are sort of people-pleasing so too much sometimes in a... you can do that in a relationship to sort of fit in or please the other person. I think we're more... I mean, this could be contentious, but I'd say we are naturally more likely to be people-pleasers.
Oh, no, I think that... I don't think that's contentious. I think that's an overhang of, like, we've had... you know, centuries of that. That's a dynamic that's been long established and part of the whole...
And we're naturally more empathetic. And I think it's partly to do with that as well. We want, you know, everything to pan out well and harmony within a group and all of that stuff.
Yeah, but again, there's certain ideals that are imposed from very early age with way we raise girls to boys that still need a bit of a rejig in terms of, as you say, like the nurture aspect. But we're also encouraged to think that if you're a little girl, you're going to want to play with the baby doll and look after that doll. And it's like, you know, all those sorts of things.
Stereotypes.
Yeah, I think there's a lot fed in from the get-go.
Yes, there is.
And I don't know if you feel it with as mother of sons. That I was very aware of that when I had my first in terms of like messaging on T-shirts and things like that.
Yeah.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I remember as a kid growing up, I wasn't a very girly girl. And in fact, I wanted to be a boy. I was just like a real tomboy. And, you know, I was brought up sort of wearing trousers the whole time anyway. And often hand-me-downs from my elder sisters. And I did have a short boy cut as well now when I come to think of it. But I look at my two sons and actually, you know, and you bring them up the same, don't you? And they turn out so, so ridiculously differently. Like I'm saying, the younger one is really sort of creative and he's like, totally can sort of focus on something and sit and invest in something. The other one, he's kind of, unless he's really, really into something, he doesn't want to have a go, he doesn't want to fail at stuff. He's a lot more anxious about stuff as well. And I don't know whether that's, you know, that can sometimes be an older child thing because they're sort of
definitely
paving the way. And I was the youngest. So I think I've always, you know, the youngest of three, I've been quite secure always. And I think naturally quite confident. I don't know. I do feel, weirdly, I feel I went through my most sort of girly phase actually in my, probably in my late teens, early 20s. And then I think when you get to sort of your late 30s, 40s, you're very secure in who you are.
Yeah.
And you're just so happy in your own skin that you don't need to people please as much.
Yeah, anymore. Yeah. A lot of it falls away, doesn't it?
Which is just so liberating.
Oh, my goodness.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. You know, I don't miss that coat at all.
No, me neither.
Although sometimes I find I've put it back on by accident and I have to take it off again.
That's probably because society makes you put it on at times.
Yeah, and I think also old habits. Was when I turned 40, I was like, that's what this decade's going to be. I'm going to try and be more unapologetic. I think it's starting to settle in. It takes a little bit of habit breaking, I think, but it's starting to settle in, which is good. It's a nice feeling, I think.
It is nice, isn't
it? Yeah, I really like it. What was happening in your life when you first had your first baby then? So your kid's 8 and 10 now,
Kids are 8 and 10. So I'd been doing actually... So me and Charlie, we decided to get lots of travelling out of the way. Like I said, so in my mid-30s, I was thinking, oh gosh, you know, this needs to be for the long haul now, any relationship, or I need to get it out of the way quickly so I can find the one that is for the long haul. And so after we got married in Vegas, and we did a road trip around Vegas.
That's so cool.
Not around Vegas, around America. That would be a small road trip.
just a couple of days.
Yeah.
We saw loads of arcades. It was amazing.
We saw loads of casinos. And then we went to Mexico. We went to Australia. We went to Japan. We went to... India. So we did loads and loads of...
Over how long? How long's that
traveling
trip?
So not over that long. So we went on different trips sort of in between work. And then I'd say... So I probably had Covey, who's my 10-year-old. I probably had him within 2 years. So we did all of that traveling. And actually, I think I then was doing a Lonely Planet series in China. So I went off to... China, and I was there for like 2 months or something in China.
Oh wow.
Yeah, it was mad. It was mad actually. China is just crazy.
In one place or moving all around?
Moving all around.
God, extraordinary.
Yes, extraordinary, because weirdly China is quite a culture shock.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even someone like Japan, you know, and I remember actually being lost in Japan before once when I'd been on a filming trip in Kyoto. And actually, I was quite terrified because it's quite easy not to find someone that speaks English.
Yeah.
But I'd say Japan has a lot more, you know, feels a lot more westernized, and you can eventually find maybe a sign with English written on, or if not, a policeman that might speak English. Whereas China, culturally, it's really weird. There's a lot of, I remember buildings just almost going up overnight. In cities, there's a lot of development, but then the countryside is so rural. And even in the cities, there's lots of sort of real elements that feel like you've been transported back to sort of the olden days, essentially. And I remember as well, actually, you know, going... I I actually came back sort of really vegetarian. And in fact, I was so thin after I came back from China. I remember a lot of the food had MSG and you could sort of see crystals of it. And that was when there was sort of, after there had been like a sort of scare over like whether MSG is bad to have, but also the thing of like things like you can buy bags of chicken claws, which they eat like crisps, and sort of lots of places with tanks full of sort of living sea creatures, and lots of sort of, because of the language barrier thing, unidentified meat, I wouldn't know what I'm actually eating. And even where there was English, I remember seeing menus where it's like sort of like fried fallopian tube or, you know, sort of esophagus. Oh. Yeah, and I would think, esophagus of what? You know, I've still got photos in my phone, actually, because I just became this ongoing thing that we'd text like these funny things like off menus, like super pig stomach and weird stuff like that. But anyway, so I think I got pregnant straight after that trip, actually, after I came back from that trip.
After the fried fallopian tubes.
Yeah, maybe it makes you really fertile. I don't know. Maybe that is a byproduct of fallopian tubes, although I don't think I did. I was vegetarian by then, so I didn't have that. I was literally, some places we go, because we're filming quite rural places.
Yeah.
And so I'd literally just be, anything that sort of looks leafy and green steamed, I'll just eat that. Mm. Because I was so like... You know, because and the food was so varied. I feel like I'm being a real food snob now, but actually, I don't eat pork anyway. And it's good anyway for climate change.
No, but I think also when you go somewhere like China, if you've never been before, the first few ways the culture shock really hits you is getting yourself something to eat somewhere new.
Yeah.
Because it makes you realize how, you know, when all the familiar.
Yes.
Places are taken away and you're like, okay, which way's up? Because you haven't worked anything out yet. You don't know what you like. You know, if the cuisine is really different.
And also, it's a production... So it was, the show was for Lonely Planet. They had their own production company. I think it was for Discovery Channel team out of Singapore. So I hadn't met any of the people I was with before I did the trip. So like you're saying, any home comfort is kind of, you know, comforting because I didn't know any of them, and everyone was from, you know, the sound guy was from Australia, and it felt like we had all just assembled for this thing from everywhere around the world, essentially. So I guess, and that was a good sort of, I say, a trip to go out on. But then for motherhood, I was very adamant that, you know, I kind of did want to do as much mothering as possible. So I still do, you know, like today after this, I'll go and do a pickup. I still do quite a lot of drop-offs and pickups, like the majority of them. Well, I remember thinking, you know, I can do it all. I'm going to be super mum. And I did this show for Sky called King of the Nerds. And I had a 5-month-old baby. And I was like, I'm not overnighting. So they were like, no, that's fine. You can get a car to Chelmsford every morning at 5 a.m. or whatever. And so literally I'd wake up and express milk. I'd wake up and express milk and then get into my car before the baby had woken up and then go and film this thing in Chelmsford. And it's one of those shows sort of like The Apprentice or, I don't know, Next Top Model, or one of those where you have two teams and essentially they are battling it out to win some sort of prize, like an activity where they go, I don't know, laser questing, whatever. And then the losing team have to lick their wounds in the mansion and someone gets voted off, which means that really you only need a presenter for the links and comparing the challenge and the rest is actuality. And so I remember I'd get there really early and I'd be willing for the show to wrap because I knew there was this window around sort of 4 o'clock, where if I got on the A406 or whatever, you know, the road from Chelmsford, that it would shave like an hour off my journey because I wouldn't hit rush hour to get back to my baby. And also, if I didn't shave that off, my boobs would be exploding with milk and it would be really painful. And so then I realised that I'm just doing everything terribly. I'm a bad mother and I'm a bad TV presenter. So I'm going, we've got that in the can. Let's move on to the next thing. I guess that sort of all of that travel and getting all of that out of the way and sort of, I feel that my life has sort of been timed, all the things that I've done have been timed quite well. So I've never really had any regrets.
But if you're someone that's always curious and liked all the sort of busyness of So how did you sort of find it when you're not filling your days with that excitement of those projects?
Well, yeah, so I guess that really happened mainly for when... So, because it does go quickly, doesn't it? And I own... So I guess... I mean, it feels like it went quickly now. At the time, I probably didn't think it went quickly. But yeah, you're right, because I didn't do... While my kids were babies, I didn't really do any work at all until they were in playgroup. So that's what, from... My eldest one went to playgroup at about 3 or 4. So... Yeah, what did I do in that time? I guess I just watched lots and lots of Peppa Pig. I guess because that is when, you know, Charlie writes from home a lot as well. Mm. And I had just as well co-written a Black Mirror. And so that had its first series probably about that point. So there's always a lot sort of going on at home, there's it feels, yeah. Where I feel like...
momentum is still around.
Yeah, that momentum of there's always... you know, some rushes of something that we're watching or, I don't know, and then the babies keep you busy as well. And there's enough sort of going on that I think it went quick enough. And then I am a sort of, like, I do like seeing people nearby, though, you know.
Yes.
And so that's, you build up this sort of network of mum for a new whole new load yeah. of friends. And you have to sort of, so not sort the wheat from the chaff, but find out who the people are that are on your wavelength.
Oh, 100%.
Which takes time in itself.
Definitely.
Almost.
You need more in common than just having a child the same age.
Yeah, absolutely.
Otherwise, like, the conversation stops quite quick,
doesn't it? The same stuff on Netflix or like liking the same music or something.
Yeah, anything.
Absolutely. So I guess, you know, and I am one of these people. My mantra is almost set your standards low, so that everything else is a bonus. So I do feel I'm quite easily pleased as a person. So... even though I did all that Blue Peter stuff, or what, I do think I find sort of happiness or joy in really simple things as well. So
as long as you've got like a focus to put things in, you're kind of quite satisfied by that.
I think a lot of people, and I think we tend to do it a lot in modern day societies, you set these goals for yourself.
Yeah.
And then you're continually disappointed if you don't reach that benchmark or if someone else does or whatever. Whereas I'm like, I don't want to ever set, probably it's that, maybe it's a fear of failure thing. I don't want to set those goals or I'll set my goals really low and then anything else is a bonus. And that means that I always achieve my low goals, but then I'm always really happy as well, I guess.
That's a good way to live. I think that's actually, we've been speaking, before we even start recording, we're talking a lot about happiness and things. And yeah, I think...
There's a lot of pressure, isn't there, now, to sort of be happy, but happy shouldn't be a pressure. It's just an innate organic thing. And yeah. I think what it feels like, it's not an innate internal organic thing. It comes from exterior stuff. And so then you're setting your goals too high and putting all your eggs in one basket often.
Yeah. Well, there's even a pressure of how to achieve the happy that you don't get from external things by, you know, I don't know, mindfulness or meditation or something. And I don't know about you, but that doesn't come easy to me at all.
So you know,
I have to
what?
Give myself permission to find it other ways.
Yeah, so I do. I literally, so my mindfulness will come from, I just love, like, and I wouldn't say I'm a gardener. I don't know much about gardening, but I'll mow our lawn and hack, like, we have loads, like you actually, you can't see our garden wall at all because of the greenery, and I love that.
Yeah,
it's
me too.
Like an oasis.
Yeah.
I love that I can't see sort of brick wall or anything,
yeah.
You know.
I get obsessed with that too, actually.
Yeah.
I like trying to frame a window so all I see is green.
Yeah, no,
that makes
I'm
me
the
really
same.
Happy.
It's really nice, actually. And we've currently got next door neighbours that are trying to want to put up a new wall, and we're like, oh, but we'll lose all our ivy. But the point being that sometimes I will literally just hack, you know, the bushes back or the ivy or something, or just clear a space and I don't know, put a bird table there or whatever it is. And that I find that's my mindfulness. And even like something like hoovering or cleaning something is my mindfulness. And I'll often do this thing, so where, as you know, I said I like doing things in but maybe not necessarily much depth. I will sometimes, like, I'll mow the lawn and then I'll get to halfway or get to, you know, a certain point, I think I'm getting a bit bored of this now. So I'll leave a really neat line, and the kids sort of have a swing set thing at the end anyway. So it looks sort of like, if I put a neat line, that's the sort of wild, mature bit with the swings in. So it still looks good to the eye, and then I'll go and do something else.
Right.
And then when I get bored of that, I'll finish mowing the lawn. You know, so I'll do things in stages where I can leave it left where it's not sort of all chaotic and half done. Like, I don't know, if I'm tidying...
So when you come back to it, you're like, okay.
Yeah, now I'll do this next... Fine. I'll do the second shelf. I'll tidy the second shelf now. I've tidied the first shelf. But I'll do it. I won't tidy the whole bookshelf. I'll tidy shelf by shelf so that I can chop and change. And so that is... I kind of do that as mindfulness.
I do actually relate to a lot of that way of being. But then how does that work when you're writing books? Because you've now done, is it three?
So that works really well because weirdly, I write all of my books on my phone.
I read that. Yeah. How are you
notes,
doing that?
You can see that they're all so...
So how are you...
Not even in Word or notes. Because the weird thing is, so my books are a bit like my brain in that. So the character in the books, she has lots of... She goes off on tangents a lot of the time.
Yes. So before we go off on too much tangent, the book is about... The girl's called Cookie.
Yes.
And this, the first book, was it just sort of 2019?
Yeah, so that's right. So So a lot of what I do... Remember I said I've got this science background. I did science A-levels. Since doing Blue Peter, a lot of stuff I do is sort of science outreach because we have a load of... young people sort of going into arts professions and other professions, but not into STEM. So we've fallen behind sort of our European counterparts and we're lagging when it comes to STEM. So kind of the books, you could say they're Bridget Jones meets Wimpy Kid, but they're also, the main character is quite sort of, she's quite science-y, she's quite practical, her mind is quite methodical. So what it is, so it's Bridget Jones meets Wimpy Kid, but an the narrative is everything that's happening to her. But then there's also illustrations, which are sort of comic strip illustrations of what's going through her brain or the tangents she goes off on, her flights of fantasy, essentially. So weirdly, I write, the books are all written almost in chunks of 500 words. Each chapter is about 1,500 words. And then those are even split up more with these pictures as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of not like writing a sort of grown-up book where you have to have, like, you know, have to sit down and do, you know, however many thousand words. It's actually, I could sometimes almost think of something when I'm in a doctor's waiting room or something, and that comes in my head and I'm like, that's a funny observation, so I'll go back and just sew it in on my phone, weirdly. So a lot of the stuff, so she sees the absurd in everyday life. So just, I don't know, as an example, if she's thinking, I don't know, just say if I see someone and I don't know, they are, I don't know, just say for an example, somebody's doing the school run and they're in really high heels or something. And then she might then go off on a flight of fantasy. Like, I wonder how high heels became a thing because they look really uncomfortable, but, and they only add a few centimetres, but then maybe, you know, I'm just giving this as an example because So she'll be, there's so many better examples of this. Okay, I'll give you an example. In the book, at one point, the teacher says she's going to make some announcements. And then the teacher says, okay, everyone settle down. I've got some announcements to make. And then literally she says, I don't know, library fines have doubled to £2 and lost property has now moved next door to the office. And then Cookie is saying, like, that's not an announcement. Why didn't she just say it? You know, to me, an announcement is I'm pregnant or I'm getting married. And so then there's a cartoon picture of someone that's pregnant saying, I've got an announcement to make. And then the person says, what is it? And then she says, I'm wearing grey socks. And he says, oh, okay, I'm off to get married now. Bye. You know, so it's just little sort of observations.
That's so fun.
So it's all funny things. So if you think of it, that might have come to me not while I'm writing that bit of the story. Yeah. Or, you know, so I'm always continually going back, sort of sewing in pictures or funny observations or comic strips. So and the actual writing, I just can do it on my phone. I can be in the garden or I can be upstairs or I can literally be like, oh, I just, I don't know, had to record a voiceover in town and there's no point in going back home because school pickup is in office. So I'm sat in the car and I've got like half an hour to kill or 20 minutes or whatever. So I'll write a couple of paragraphs then and then. Weirdly, because of the way her mind works, it kind of works really well.
Yeah.
Writing in that frenetic way with the style that. Of the book.
So what is your relationship with her? What's it like to create a protagonist?
So I would say, so she is, I guess, like a version of me that's highly caricatured, because obviously, if I was just writing about me growing up, it would probably be really boring. So everything's a bit heightened. So she's got that Bridget Jones element of, like, chaos follows her about, or everything's a catastrophe. But, you know, we were chatting before and I was saying everyone gets that thing of sort of imposter syndrome where you just think, I'm just going through life blagging it or bluffing it. When will I be found out? So she will have sort of internal tussles like that. And then she'll say, no, I can do this. And then she'll blurt something out where she sort of goes too far or screws it up. She's overly confident or whatever.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, I might have that thought in my head, but I might not necessarily blurt it out. I might. She's like me, but dialed down.
Yeah.
If you see what I mean. And also to get sort of funny things happening, like set pieces, it often needs to go, because there's no magic in it, there's no witches and wizards, or there's nothing fantastical. It's literally about a kid that goes to school and falls out with her friends and makes up with them.
Yeah.
So you need something to be interesting, you know, so there will be things so that go wrong. For instance, like she has a science experiment that might explode and whatever, where I might have had an experiment that went wrong, but it wouldn't necessarily yeah. drench me. And, you know, but everything is based on real stuff. So, for instance, in book one, she goes on a quiz show to represent her school. And I did go on Blockbusters to represent my school, and I got nothing right. Well, I only managed to buzz in on two questions, which are the two questions she got asked. What B is to cast a spell? And I said to bind a spell. And the answer was bewitch, apparently. And then... Oh,
I think bind is a great answer.
Yeah, so do I. I think I should have got that. And then we would have actually won if I had got that. Anyway, and then I also got... And she gets asked these same questions, so I'm obviously exorcising my demons. What P is clear? I didn't buzz in because in blood cells. And I knew plasma, but we'd been taught it's yellow, straw-coloured plasma. Right. And they said it was... Anyway, the point being, she goes on a quiz show and gets no questions right. And then, for instance, in book two, for instance, which is all to do with saving the planet and being eco, they join this forest club and they go on this camping trip and she has to go on this zip wire. And I had to do that with the Royal Marines when I went training on the Royal Marines training course. And I've got tiny hands and you have to clutch. They don't have safety harnesses. Thank goodness I do. You have to clutch around this thing, this rope thing called a strop. And I couldn't actually get purchase round it to grip properly. And I think this Sergeant Major guy just thought I'm making excuses because I'm scared. I don't actually have a problem with heights or anything like that. It was just literally, I don't think I'll be able
my
to.
My tiny hands.
And he's
can't
like,
grip.
No, you'll be fine. And he just like pushed me out. And I actually am fall off this thing and I'm hanging like a rattle. It's actually on YouTube. I watch it now and I laugh because it is hilarious. And you can hear me on my mic going, so I sound like I'm dying. Anyway, Cookie has the same thing.
I have small hands too. I shouldn't do
that. Yeah, don't do that death slide. They do it without, it's called the Royal Marines death slide. They do it without a safety harness.
Yeah, but they're Marines.
I know.
Small-handed people like us need to be protected.
So that happens to her. And then, like, for instance, in the last book, there's a bit where she's doing this show at school and she comes off stage and her mic's still on and she's blurting out all this stuff to her friend. And everyone's listening to it. And that, I mean, you'll know, that's happened so many times in telly where people come off air and their mic is... So everything is built around real things that have actually happened.
But it sounds like you really love
I really enjoyed it. It's really good fun. I just love thinking the gags and the...
Yeah.
And also, what would she do in this situation? How would her mind work? Or what's the tangent she goes off on? Or the point that she misses in this. I really enjoyed writing
it's them. A good space to go in your head as well. I mean, when I'm listening to you talk, I might be really wrong, but I get this idea of like you and your husband and you have really exciting ways of thinking about the world and there's lots of curiosity and questioning and looking out and thinking about how things... So how does that tessellate with the sort of traditional aspects of parenthood? Because a lot of it, when you become parents, there's a lot of things.
We're probably terrible parents, is how it does. I mean, I always say this thing of light. I just remembered how badly we're getting it wrong when one of our kids came into the kitchen and then went, Alexa, I mean, Daddy. And I was like, oh no, this is terrible. What has happened? But You know, his dad used to sort of watch comedy with him from a young age, and we love comedy. And I think my eldest has got a really weird sense of humour, which I think is quite like Charlie. Like, Charlie has got a weird mind, and so has Covey. And he's always sort of playing the fool or the entertainer. I mean, I guess they... And the youngest is always questioning stuff. So I do... I suppose, like, I don't know, I think the same of your house, because I think, you know, you've got five kids and you're both sort of creatives, and so it's kind of like never a dull moment, I'd say, probably in your house and in our house. But then what house with kids ever has a dull moment? I mean, yeah. There's always some drama going on.
I actually read a... I think, I don't know if it was you or Charlie that said it, and I thought, I found it really reassuring, and I thought, it said something like, I mean, this is obviously a while back, it says our kids are 6 and 8, so they're basically a law unto themselves, so there's only so much we can do as parents from this point onwards. And I thought, that's so brilliant, because actually that is true.
Yeah.
They're their own people, yes. They do their own thing. And I think it's, especially now, like, parenthood is so spoken about and talked about, methods of parenting.
Yes, so structured.
It's actually very suffocating.
So structured. Absolutely right. So if you think about it, so I always say this thing of, like, when I was growing up, my parents would literally, I'd just fit in around them. Mm. And all of us, all three of us, and all people growing up in our generation, we'd all fit around our parents. We'd be dragged where they were going. We'd do what they did. You know, we'd have to amuse ourselves. You know, the amount of times I remember sitting outside, so they would go to Macro. I don't know if you know what
Macro,
the cash and carry, but you weren't allowed in till you were 12.
Mm.
And so there was this car park full of cars, of just kids sitting in these cars waiting for their parents to come. And you'd be carted off to social services now if that happened. But so you'd make your own entertainment. You'd be sat in this car for like an hour, and I Spy would run out quite quickly or whatever. So you'd make your own entertainment. And similarly, you know, I remember being at parents' friends' houses, and we'd be upstairs, the kids would all just be hanging around upstairs in the bedrooms or whatever, and I'd end up falling asleep on a pile of coats, you know, on a double bed, and my dad would pick me up asleep still off this pile of coats, and, you know, I'd be put in the back seat of the car, and then we'd get home and he'd just take my shoes off and shove me in bed, and I'd wake up the next morning still in the party dress or whatever. And, you know, now it's sort of like, you know, it's bath and bedtime at 5 o'clock and they've got ballet at this time or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And it's like we're all, you know, fitting in around them. And actually we turned out all right, I think, didn't we?
Yeah.
And we've, you know, that entertainment in the car in the car park of Macro that we had to make for ourselves.
I feel like I was always being left in the car when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I feel like that was a really common thing. Just wait here for a minute, I've got to go and do X, Y, Z.
I'm going to nip into that shop there.
It's constantly just sat in the car.
Yeah, whereas now, you know, if I left my kid in the car, he'd probably be screaming or crying or, you know, so they're totally, their brains are wired so differently, young kids today, from how ours were, just from everything, the neural pathways, because of the fact that, you know, they have much more instant gratification because they're living in a time where everything is so sort of instantaneous. Yeah. And
but also I think
so fast.
The emphasis on the parents to be the provider of everything, the soul, you know, the one to equip them with all the life tools, because you want to raise nice people here, don't you, who can handle their emotions and be kind to people and be ambitious, but the right level of ambition and happy with what they have, but also, you know, striving for something. It's like, oh my, it's all on you to provide all those tools.
Yes.
So when I read that quote, I thought, it's so, I'm only one part of what's happening in their childhood.
Totally.
I'm not like the absolute everything.
No,
I'm
because
just
if
the
you
mum
think
role.
A big part of our childhood was the surroundings of the Macro car park or
whatever,
you know, all of that stuff. Whereas it feels like people are just tiger parenting left, right, and centre.
Yeah.
And everything's so competitive down to, I don't know, birthday parties and goodie bags and tutoring and after school clubs and all of that stuff, which we kind of didn't, we weren't subjected to nearly half of it, were we, growing up?
No, and quite happily not, actually. And I did wonder, actually, with you, because your parents, you said they came over from Bangladesh and, like, they made decisions to give you a different childhood to the one they had. What's the sort of, what would be something that's a takeaway from that other people who haven't had that have?
Well, weirdly, so although I didn't have their childhood, obviously you get influenced a lot by your parents. So my mum, she didn't even go to university or anything like that. You know, she would have dropped out of, you know, done, she did sort of primary schooling, essentially. And so she wasn't sort of educated. My dad did go to university. We came over. I wasn't born then, was I? But they came over because he got a job with Prudential in Holborn, who were recruiting from abroad for people to be actuaries, essentially. But then, so if you think of it, she had sort of come, and they were from a village. You know, I went back with Blue Peter filming in the village.
Really?
Yeah.
That's what took you back? That's the first time you'd been there?
So no, I had been there. So actually, because, you know, as well, when we were growing up, Sophie, I'm making us out like we're so old, but I mean, when we did grow up...
We're pretty much the same age.
If you think of it, though, yeah, EasyJet and stuff didn't exist. Cheap flights weren't a thing.
No.
And so often...
We are from a different... Very different, like, standpoint for how modern life is. Definitely.
Yeah, totally. And so my parents sort of took us on a big family holiday to Bangladesh because, you know, that's a sort of long-haul flight. When I was 14, and that was the first time I'd seen Bangladesh. And, you know, I went to the village. They hired a van and drove us all around. So we saw everything, but, you know, I saw shanty towns, you know, and there's this big one in the capital where literally kids and families are all living in shacks alongside a railway line. And there's these kids and they're playing on the railway line. You can Google image it. It's madness. And then every now and then a train comes and everyone runs off the railway line. It's just bonkers. And yeah. We went back there filming on to that very shanty town with Blue Peter when I got the job on Blue Peter. And I do remember, you know, and I can speak a bit of Bengali, and they were like, you know, stay for lunch, stay for dinner. They were so, like, privileged that we'd come to film them. They have nothing, and they were sort of offering us everything. But they were really happy as well. The kids were playing happily, and they were all so smiley, and they just seemed so happy. And the family that we were sort of hanging out with, they seemed so happy. And they, you know, they have nothing, and yet they offer you everything, but they seem happy.
Mm.
And, you know, over here, and I don't know, maybe... It's not a case, but it just feels to me now, and maybe I'm noticing it more because I'm a parent of young children, but there seem to be my sort of more and more friends I have whose kids have got anxiety or sort of have got, you know, need to go and see a therapist or whatever. It feels like mental well-being, I don't know, is, and I could be wrong, I don't know. It seems that simple lifestyle, I mean maybe they don't have the sort of privilege to be able to have the mental issues of X, Y, and Z.
No, you're right.
Because they're sort
mean.
Of trying to feed themselves, if you see what I mean.
Or maybe that there's some messaging that's a bit overwhelming and we've sort of... I mean, it's hot. We do have a very consumerist culture. There's lots of things that you're encouraged to feel. You've got to do this, that, and the other to achieve things. And I know there's lots of things, probably mistakes I make about... trying to work out what job they're going to do when they're older, when they're really too little to really just know how they want to dress themselves or whatever.
Because, you know, as parents, I think we all feel like that. Mm. And I'm like, really, if my kid is, I don't know, sweeping roads, but they're really happier, that's much better than them being the CEO of a company, but they're unhappy. But
yeah.
I know that that's true. But in this environment that we're in, I still... can't get my head around the fact that that's true. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because we're part of it too. We're sort of living that life and going, oh, actually this, I don't know, I like going to that place for my coffee and this is how I do this.
And you know why I think it is? I think it's because I might feel embarrassed to say, oh, my kid, they're really happy, but for a living, I don't know, they're cleaning poo or whatever they're doing. I don't know, I'm trying to think of the thing that most people would aspire not to do without insulting any job, because any good job is a good job in its own right. I don't want to be snobby against any job.
The specific cleaning poo.
No, and I said cleaning poo as opposed to, I don't know, being a carer or a road sweeper or any of those things, because those things are actually really gratifying, which is like, because Pete, and so it goes back to the thing of...
It's really tickled me for some reason.
It goes back to the thing of, if you're doing something like a profession, which is like a caring profession, it's a people profession. And actually, when I went filming with the Red Cross to Angola, I remember I was like, oh, what, I'm staying in the Red Cross house? Okay. Well, there's no running water, whatever it was. So I was in this house in Angola for 2 weeks. And I was like, wow, these people are amazing. They give up their life to be an NGO worker, and they get posted to this country, and then they have to, you know, and there's loads of NGOs, the Halo Trust, Médecins Sans Frontières, the Red Cross, whatever, and they're all living in these houses and they're so selfless and all of this stuff. And I was like, oh, I could never do that. They're amazing. And actually, after that 2 weeks, weirdly, I was like, this is such fun. And it's sort of like being in a student house with these insanely interesting people that have been, I don't know, shot at in Afghanistan or whatever. They've just got all these adventures. And they're having these sort of expat parties with other like-minded people who are all from all around the world and everything. And I actually really loved it. And then you come back into your bubble, and even now I'm like, oh, I could never do that. How do they do that? But at the time, I was like, this is brilliant. And it's that thing of you don't realise how brilliant, you don't realise how something's brilliant till you're in it. So if you're really insanely happy doing cleaning the poo, to take it back to that, the base level, because I'm a children's book writer and it's all about poo and wee. But, you know, you actually, when you're on the outside, you're like, oh, I don't want to do that. I couldn't do that. And you can't believe that you could ever be happy being on the inside. But then when you're in the inside, you're like, I'm so happy here.
Yeah. I think it reminds me of a conversation I had a really long time ago with an artist who lives around here. And she said that for her, the key to sort of like mental well-being was to find a purpose bigger than herself, like find a cause bigger than herself. Yeah. So once she was engaged in that, it took her up and out of her own... the noise in your brain.
Because it's a kind of, and I hesitate to say this, but I do remember sort of my mum sort of, and you know, there's nothing to poo-poo therapy or any of that stuff, but I remember when her mum died, you know, and she was really sad and she cried for a couple of days or whatever, and then, you know, she was sort of like, okay, business as usual or whatever. And when I went to Angola with that Red Cross trip, I remember the Red Cross saying to me, look, every family has got one person dead or missing in Angola. You know, the mentality here is very different. And it's not that you don't care or whatever, but there's mouths to feed.
Yeah.
So there's bigger fish to fry. And it's not that, you know, that of course you're sad if someone passes away or any trauma you're sad about.
Yeah.
But, like, you have to some extent get it into perspective. Otherwise you wouldn't be able to carry on with your life. Whereas over here, we don't necessarily need to, because we could still carry on with our life if we're indulging in it, if that makes sense. Because, you know, our problems are different. We have a difference, and not to detract from the problems we have.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're different. You know, we are often saying first world problems, aren't we?
Yes.
And it's kind of true, because it doesn't mean that the hurt or the pain caused by that problem isn't real to that person. But it might be the same as the hurt and the pain of a bigger problem to someone elsewhere.
Yeah.
But you've magnified the pain in relation to the cause, because we can, because we're living in a different set of circumstances, essentially. So to bring it back to your initial question, what was that, like, what did your parents sort of...
I wasn't remembering the initial question.
Yeah, it was to do with that my parents lived a different life.
No, you're right.
And they came over and they brought me up here, but what did I get from that?
Yeah.
Well, that my mum would always say to me sort of like, you know, take less food on your plate and finish what's on your plate, then take more, but don't leave half of that stuff on the plate. Because where she had come from, that half stuff that you're scraping off into the bin, that could have fed someone and kept them alive. And so it gave me that perspective, which means, weirdly, I think had I not had them as parents, I think I'd be much more into consumer things, because I'm totally lulled by those things. And especially in my teenage years, I definitely sort of was totally into those things. But internally, my wiring means that somehow I feel guilt on some level to sort of do too much expenditure. And it's all to do with just how I'm wired, because we're only all selfish people. So because I don't want to feel that guilt, or necessarily get, you know, make that extra purchase or whatever. But we're all doing things to make ourselves happy, and it's how we've been wired to feel happy.
Definitely.
Which needs to start at the 0 to 7. Because you can't preach your values to other people, because they're already wired by then. So weirdly, you know, if people are saying, Jacob Rees-Mogg or Boris Johnson, whatever, whoever it is, Trump or whoever the person is that they don't agree with, those people have just been wired differently. And so they can't see it, because their happiness and their sadness is dictated by a totally different set of values. Yeah. And that set of values isn't lesser or more, because it's just to do with the pain that it causes mentally to them inside, which means we need to rewire them from the beginning to make sure it correlates to things that merit it.
Yes.
But it's not their fault if it's not correlated like that later on, because it's too late, if yeah. that makes sense.
That's kind of...
It's kind of like a bitter pill to swallow, because yeah. it really means we can only solve the world's problems through kids and getting them right really early on. Because then if they have that, you know, if their barometer is set right, then if they are the president of America, they will get their happiness by giving healthcare. Or if they're the yeah. CEO of a company, they'll get their happiness by not increasing fat cat salaries, but workers' pay or whatever. Whatever they do, they will have enough empathy and altruism and enough guilt or mental unhappiness by doing the wrong things to do the right things. Because at the end of the day, we only sort of do things to please ourselves because we are innately selfish.
Yeah. Just wish I could just go back to the beginning of my child raising and just do something a little bit different.
No, but it's not on you. It's on your parents. Well, it isn't on your parents. As we said, it's on your environment.
Yes.
But so it's on the car in macro and it's on all of that environmental stuff.
Yes.
It's on everything. So it's not the parents. It's not the teachers. It's not the government. It's everything altogether.
It's everything.
Including being in the car park in macro.
So the enormity of that, how does that help you with your... With your kids, how are you implementing?
Well, they're just if I give them the values that I do think are right from that 0 to 7, then they'll do all the rest themselves. Because my parents gave me those values and I rebelled against it. I used to think, oh, Mum, who cares if you have to scrape some food off or whatever? Or I don't care if I've got too many pairs of 501s. I like it and it's making me all of that stuff. And you go through that. But like I say, when you revert later on to being happy in your own skin, you kind of weirdly revert a bit more to those values that your parents got instilled in you. Even though in your 20s or whatever, you might, I don't know, take those drugs or do whatever it is, I do think you still always revert back fundamentally to the 0 to 7 values.
Yeah. So do you hear yourself?
And it might not be reverting back. Some people might have kept that lifestyle from 0 to 7 all the way through, so they don't need to revert back.
Yeah. But do you feel, can you hear yourself saying the things you're parents would have said then?
Definitely. Like, definitely.
Funny, isn't it?
I will tell my kids, you know, you can have more if you eat that, you know, but don't put that and then scrape off half in the bit. You know, I definitely, my parents were so like, don't want things wasted ever. And I'm the same. I don't like wasting things. I remember just stupid stuff like my mum, you know, a kitchen roll, the square of kitchen roll. She'd sometimes, like, if there was some orange juice and it's just a little spot, she'd rip off half and spot it rather than ripping off a whole one. But the half was enough to get rid of it. It's just like a dot of orange juice on a counter or whatever. Yeah. But at the time, I think, oh, that's so stupid. But I might do that now, you know.
Yeah.
Something, because I think, well, then, you know, you've got double the amount of kitchen roll. Don't get me wrong. If it's a big splot, go for the whole sheet. But just little things like that at every level. And it's that whole mentality of little things can make big differences if everyone does it.
Yeah.
But the problem is everyone doesn't do it because we've all been brought up differently.
Yeah, so
but
I suppose...
our kids are halfway there because they're teaching all this stuff in schools of using less plastic and like walking instead of driving or whatever it is. So
the conversations are
happening.
Yeah, we
didn't have that when we were growing up.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, and I'm probably only all like that because my mum and dad were just like that because they grew up in an environment where you weren't wasting stuff because it was part of everything that they had surrounding them.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's always so much to unpick, and you start to look at it more closely as well as your kids get older, and then you think about the things you remember from when you were little and all that stuff. And
it sounds so pious when you're saying it to someone that isn't of that mindset, because it is, because the values are totally different, and it does look like, oh, you're being stingy, but or you're being whatever with that kitchen roll. But it isn't to do with stingy, it's to do with valuing things. And also knowing that if... You can hold hands, like it's what we were saying before, actually, before we started recording the podcast, in our pre-podcast musings, that if you're in the middle, you can reach a hand up to someone at the top and someone at the bottom, and you're not out of touch with anything. You can not be overawed at a mansion, you can not be snobby at a council flat or a shantytown shack or whatever. But the spread of wealth is only getting higher at the top end. Because you can still get richer and richer and richer on every level, But you can't get poorer than having nothing. And so inequality is just getting crazy. So if we can all just stick to being a bit in the middle, then we can reach people on both ends and we've got a chance. Whereas if it's going to spread to a bonkers scale, then suddenly you just can't, you can't relate to people that aren't in your sort of subset, essentially.
Yeah.
Which yeah. is really sad. Because this has all really only happened since this post-war period.
Exactly.
Yeah, because before that, sort of consumerism wasn't really... You know, we didn't have mass production. So it's in a very short space of time that all this is happening.
And everything's going so fast. Happened.
It's going so fast and it's only getting faster and faster. If you think for millions of years, humans were hunter-gatherers, not changing much at all. Every new change leads to 10 more changes. You know, we learned to have settlements and then we could farm food on a bigger scale and we learned how to convert energy so we could have steam trains and travel places, and now look, we've got technology, we've got the internet, all of this stuff. It's just moving at a bonkers pace and it isn't sustainable with sort of climate change and carbon footprint and the climate crisis essentially. But hopefully, sorry kids, but you 0 to 7 year olds, you can fix it all.
Yeah. Maybe. I've only got two in that category now, and I feel one of them I've nearly six.
You're running out of time.
When okay. he comes home from school, I'm going to be like,
we've got grandkids.
Yes, I could cover a few things I might have left out.
But, you know, it's just to cover it on a very sort of small level, because it literally, this is all, my mindset is like this just because of sort of just really stupid things like not being allowed to scrape food off into a bin or whatever.
But but that stuff matters. It does matter. And I think it's amazing that when you've got all the big life experiences, that's things like that everyday thing, that's actually what's really become part of your...
You're right, it's the little everyday things. Because something like you could go to someone's house and, I don't know, they could have Fortnum and Mason ketchup, because we were discussing ketchup earlier in our pre-podcast.
Heinz or take it away.
Yeah, or you could have, I don't know, Lidl ketchup, right? But if you're only used to going to the house with Fortnum and Mason ketchup, then you're going to be really, you won't help but to go, oh, their ketchup's from Lidl, if that makes sense. Whereas if you're in the middle, you know, you can relate, you can sort of, like I say, not go, oh, they've got Fortnum and Mason ketchup. You can sort of not be too overawed by that and not be snobby against the Lidl ketchup. It's just ketchup. It's squashed tomatoes, you know. And actually you want, a big part of the problem today is snobbery.
Yeah.
You know, and snobbery is awful because it makes us all want stuff because we don't want to be judged. So I think a lot of when we're getting stuff to feel happy is because actually it's not even necessarily to please ourselves. It's the people looking at us being impressed by what we have.
Yeah.
And how nice, I don't know, our clothing or our holiday pictures are or whatever it is. So it's a weird one.
So with you, this seems like something that isn't just something you're passionate about, but sounds very well-formed view of things. Is this something you're putting into projects?
Obviously, I'm an ambassador for Kew Gardens and actually a climate change charity, which is called Mothers Rise Up, which I guess is very kind of relevant to everything that we've been saying. And I do a lot of sort of stuff, obviously, around the books, like events with kids, where so the whole of Cookie Book 2 is all to do with sort of saving the planet. But, you know, I try and put it into everything. Like even this podcast, I guess I've put it into this somehow.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, I'd never be a politician or anything. I'd hate to be in politics. My sister's in politics and I'm just like, why would you do a thing like that? I just try and put it in. I mean, I think I subconsciously put it into stuff because it is something that I'm passionate about. Yeah, so in all of the cookie books, you know, I'm always saying they're not dumbing down, because why dumb down? Intelligence up. But then do it through humour and so that it's an attractive prospect rather than education. You know, so...
No, that stuff. So I think that's the way to do it, by sort of stealth. And
yeah, stealth.
And I think I'm very reassured that if I have got some of this a little bit wrong already, at least your kids will be getting it right. So I'm
I know you, and I know you well enough that I think your kids are going to turn out good.
It's such a long game.
But you know what, like you said, it's not on our shoulders, because it's everything that they're surrounded by. You know, you can't govern social media.
No.
As a parent, you can maybe go, hey, until a certain age, maybe don't look at that website, but look at this website, or put some sort of parental controls. But actually, you know, there's a program on Radio 4 the other day, Social Injustice, but they were saying this very thing of, even if you don't subscribe to it, it's so omnipresent. You're a part of it because you can't help it. It's the infrastructure we're in now.
Yeah. I feel like you and I could probably have this conversation for like another 4 hours.
Yeah, actually. Well, we already had 4 hours before we started pressing the record button. So maybe we'll press the stop button.
This is part one. We'll do part two.
We'll do a spin-off podcast.
Exactly. Yeah, we will. Yeah, just do our own.
And another thing. Yeah. Putting the world to rights.
That's perfect. And another thing.
And another thing.
Sophie and Connie put the world to rights.
Yeah.
And another thing. Thank you for talking to me. Do you want to know something really funny? You said you're analog and not digital, but I think you're the only person I've spoken to who has looked things up on their phone while we've been chatting.
Oh, really? Okay.
So I beg to differ, Connie, actually.
In today's society, there is no analog, unfortunately.
No.
It's too late.
I love tech anyway. Yeah. Bring it on.
And, you know, like I said, I was saying in the conversation before, and then we'll end this podcast. You know, it's interactive. It's not like... any kid that's on an app or on a game, as long as it's the right app or the right game, it's not just mindlessly watching, I don't know, YouTubers smashing up stuff.
No.
You know, so it used in the right way, tech is brilliant.
Oh, and not only that, I think what I would hope that other people raising young people would understand is that it is how the world is now. So,
you know,
we still see things like iPads and stuff as a kind of luxury item. But for kids, that's literally just how they access information. And there's a lot of stuff they come... My children come out with things and I'm like, how do you know that? They go, oh, I watched something on this about it. And I'm like, brilliant, good. Go forth and find it.
Yeah, there was a time when people thought books were the enemy.
Exactly.
You know? So it's just progress, that's all.
Progress, exactly. No, I love it. Here's to all that. But it's been so good to talk to you.
Thank you.
We can keep
much.
Chatting more after this as well.
Let's do that. Okay, press that stop button and we'll go and carry on.
Exactly.
Ah, that was good energy. I actually genuinely feel more perked up now. And, I mean, isn't Connie great to listen to? So many amazing thoughts going on. And I love her books, by the way. They're really... gorgeous, and the illustrations are gorgeous, and it's just got a real affection in the pages and wit. So if you haven't checked out the cookie books, go and have a look. Lovely to chat to her as ever, and that was a really fun conversation to record. I really enjoyed it, and I've got many more lovely conversations coming your way, and I've now got a bag on the floor that I've got to zip up, filled with my sparkly bits and my makeup, and I'm on my way to Norwich today. It's going to be a little bit strange because Richard was supposed to be coming with me, but he's got a job that he's got to go in the studio for today. So I'm going on my own. And the reason why that's odd is because he was going to do the cooking demo with me today. So I'm doing a festival called Foodies Fest. And at a lot of festivals we've been doing in the summer, like Pub in the Park and Car Fest, Richard and I have done a little cooking demonstration for our cookbook. And we like doing it together. And it means, you know, you get that nice chat between the two of us while we're prepping stuff. Well, today I'm going on my own, but they'd already billed that I was doing the cooking. So I've got a sort of stand-in husband, a chef who's already on site, who's going to cook with me. And probably that'd be really nice, but it's just a little bit different. Oh, sorry, I missed now. I can hear little Mickey's voice. Anyway, I'm off to Norwich. You're off doing whatever you're going to do. I hope you're feeling okay. And whatever your emotions have been stirred in you from this week, and you know the Queen's, you know, sad death and new beginnings with King Charles III. That sounds pretty crazy, doesn't it? I hope you're doing okay, because I know for some people, and I said this to my friend, the Queen, like the last few pictures of her, she looked so like my granny. She looked so like Sybil Baxter, who died. She must have died 3 years ago now. I miss my granny, and it really reminded me of my granny. And I do think that sometimes when, you know, the tone in the news is one of heaviness and grief and mourning and all these things are spoken about, and we look reflecting on a life, it makes you think about your own life, doesn't it? But also people you've lost. I don't know how you'd avoid that train of thought, really. So if that's been something that's been really hard for you, then I'm sending you a hug. And if you feel fancy free and you're not really thinking about it, that is obviously fine too. And on that note, I'm going to go off and cook some clam pasta and sing for the good people of Norwich. And I will see you next week.
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.